Lots of people choose to buy organic eggs because they assume the chickens that laid them get to enjoy blue skies and green pastures.
I think it's worth spending an extra few dollars.
But that's not always the case. I'm Kara Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, a controversial new rule that would clarify how farmers treat organic poultry might never make it to the chicken coop. And to some people's dismay, natural gas production is ramping up in Pennsylvania, in part because of a pipeline boom.
If you're going to build out the infrastructure, then that's the reason to keep extracting natural gas.
Plus, a new study finds that much of our fresh water is getting saltier.
Rock salt that you put on your sidewalk isn't going to just disappear and vanish into the atmosphere. It ends up in our rivers and streams.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A Marcellus Shale gas well could be coming to Pennsylvania's oldest working steel mill. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports for State Impact Pennsylvania that a company plans to drill six wells at U.S. Steel's Edgar Thompson Works near Pittsburgh.
New Mexico-based Marion Oil and Gas plans to drill on the eastern edge of the steel mill, which was built in 1875 by Andrew Carnegie. Ryan Davis is operations manager with Marion Oil and Gas. He says the noise and traffic of the steel mill means noise and traffic from the drilling won't be so noticeable.
The industrial area makes us unique, allows us to kind of blend in with the current activity that's there.
Local groups opposed a short-lived plan for fracking at a nearby golf course in 2014. Some now worry increased truck traffic and emissions from fracking could add to air pollution already coming from the Edgar Thompson Works. Davis said the company will hold town hall-style meetings to address public concerns.
Most of the time, people are antsy or scared of you know, the oil and gas development because they don't understand the process.
The project will need permits from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the Allegheny County Health Department. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Pennsylvania gas producers emerged from 2017 on more solid footing than the previous year, when activity in the gas field slowed amid low prices. But operators ramped up drilling in 2017, and they're expecting to drill even more this year. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports for State Impact Pennsylvania.
In a quarter mile, the destination is on your right.
There it is. There's a rig up right on top of that hill.
I'm at the site of Pennsylvania's newest gas wells. Nine are going on a pad in rural Washington County. Drilling started here a few days ago in Frank Brownlee's backyard. He shows me around in his pickup.
This is a well pad right here. And this is a well pad over here.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere.
Now, he'll have one a quarter mile from his house. Operators drilled 137 wells in Washington County in 2016. But in 2017, they put in more than 200, including the ones going in here. Brownlee owns a trucking company. All this activity is good for business, which had slowed the last couple years.
Well, right now we haul a lot of tanks onto the frack sites whenever we're doing the fracking.
Like today, his drivers are moving 40 of them. Brownlee looks to the rig up on his hill.
We'll be on that site sooner or later with the tanks.
So, what's driven the flurry of activity in 2017? Emery Kugler is an analyst with IHS Market.
The past couple of months, and then for the first quarter of 2018, there's a lot of pipeline capacity coming online.
More pipelines will allow more gas to flow to market. By spring, several new lines will send Pennsylvania gas to the south, mainly to generate electricity. Kugler says drilling ramped up in anticipation of that, and he expects that to continue into 2018. But gone are the days of 100 rigs drilling statewide, like in 2012 during the boom. Today, there are 30. Dave Spiegelmeyer is with the Marcellus Shale Coalition. It's a trade group for the gas industry.
The operators have learned to be far more efficient.
He says they're concentrating drilling in the regions where they can get the most bang for their buck, like here in the southwest and in the northeastern part of the state. And the wells in these high-producing areas are getting longer, some even 17,000 feet. Here's Kugler again.
So you're getting the equivalent of three wells inside of one well.
But drilling has always been controversial, as is the prospect of more wells. Ned Kitire is a retired pediatrician in Washington County. He's outspoken about climate change and the harm he says the natural gas industry can cause to human health.
What we thought of as shale gas development 10 years ago, when things were really starting to ramp up, it's a totally different situation now.
A decade into the shale fracking boom, many pipelines and processing facilities have emerged alongside drilling. Kitire is concerned this creates a never-ending cycle.
If you're going to build out the infrastructure, then that's the reason to keep extracting natural gas.
He's leery about the possibility of more drilling to feed a new facility in southwestern Pennsylvania. Shell is building a plant to turn ethane into plastic. Ethane comes to the Earth's surface from wells along with pure natural gas. Spiegelmeyer with the Shale Coalition is eager for projects like this that'll provide a market for gas right here in Pennsylvania.
I drove by that plant a little over a week ago, and I think there's 9 cranes.
Construction is still years from wrapping up, but it's a sign that there will be a demand for new wells down the road. More drilling will affect residents here, including Brownlee.
Yeah, everything will pick up now. I think the trucking industry will keep picking up.
Keeping his drivers busy hauling tanks from one new well pad to the next. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
One promise President Trump made during his campaign was that his administration would end what he and his supporters call the war on coal. Recently, a federal agency rejected a Trump administration proposal that would have propped up the struggling coal industry. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier is here to explain what happened. Hi, Reed.
Hi, Kara.
So this proposal to help coal out was a pet project of Energy Secretary Rick Perry. What did he want to do?
Just for some background, nuclear and coal industries have really been struggling mostly because of increasingly cheap natural gas. It's sort of priced them out of the market, especially in this part of the country, Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic. And some of these plants have been closing or are scheduled to close. Three Mile Island, for instance, the iconic nuclear plant near Harrisburg, is talking about closing early, ahead of schedule. So Rick Perry wanted to prop up these legacy plants by basically allowing them to charge more, sort of guarantee profits for these companies, have them be more able to compete with cheaper natural gas and increasingly renewables like wind and solar. What he did was say that plants that can keep this 90-day supply of fuel on site would be guaranteed a sort of premium price for their energy. And the only plants that fit this bill are coal and nuclear. You can't keep 90 days of natural gas on site, same with wind and solar. And his rationale was that if there's some sort of hurricane or other sort of natural disaster or man-made disaster, these plants could keep running for 90 days. Otherwise, possibly the grid could go dark.
That sounds kind of scary. Could that really happen?
A lot of people say no. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, I talked with Ben Storo. He's a reporter with E&E News. And here's how he explained what people are saying about that question. Would the grid actually go dark if there was some sort of disaster?
There's a consulting group, the Rhodium Group. They did a study. They looked at federal data of power outages, and they found that 0.00007% of all power outages in the last 5 years were due to fuel supply problems. So at its most basic, the criticism of this plan is that it's trying to solve for a problem that doesn't really exist.
And there was a lot of opposition to this plan from a really broad spectrum of entities that don't usually agree. For instance, for obvious reasons, the renewable energy industry was against it because it would really hurt them. But also the oil and gas industry was against it because it would kind of favor coal and nuclear over natural gas. And, people who were really gung-ho about the free market were
against it because they thought it was tipping the scales in the direction of one energy source over another.
Well, all of this is kind of moot now because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission nixed the proposal.
That's right. So FERC is an independent body with both Republican and Democratic members. It's five members on the board, and they unanimously rejected the proposal. It's worth it to note that four out of the five members on FERC's body were appointed by President Trump. So it's kind of a resounding defeat for Rick Perry. But it's not like the issue is going to go away. You know, these plants are still going to struggle. There's still going to be a push to keep them online, both for political reasons, but also for practical reasons. I don't think anybody in the electric utility industry wants all coal and nuclear plants to just stop working. For one thing, nuclear energy is our largest source of carbon-free energy right now, and it accounts for about 20% of our electricity nationwide. So if gas starts to push coal off the grid, that would actually be bad for, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. So one thing that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission did was say it would begin a new process to study whether fewer coal and nuclear plants pose a risk to the availability of electricity, especially during these natural disaster type scenarios.
You know, you mentioned that this was an unpopular proposal for a lot of entities, including grid operators. What are they doing to kind of bolster reliability without this emphasis on specifically helping out the coal industry?
Well, the grid operator in Pennsylvania and much of the Mid-Atlantic and the upper kind of Rust Belt, basically from Washington, D.C. to Chicago, is called PJM Interconnection. Something like 60 million people get their electricity off of it. And PJM has its own plan to keep coal and nuclear plants in the mix. It would allow coal and nuclear plants to charge more for their electricity, which is kind of similar to the Department of Energy plan, but PJM thinks it would actually be better for consumers than the DOE's proposal.
And this is something that would be passed along to ratepayers?
Yeah, so PJM says its proposal would cost ratepayers an additional 2 to 5% more in electricity bills. And the estimates for Rick Perry's proposal put the cost, there was a wide range of estimates. Since his proposal was so devoid of details, it was sort of hard to pin down, but the cost could have been as much as 10 times more PJM's.
Now that this Energy Department proposal has failed, does the Trump administration have any other plans going forward to bail out coal?
We don't really know for sure what the Trump administration is going to do going forward, but we do know it's going to try. So in Congress right now, there's lobbying being done from the coal and nuclear industries to actually just give them, you know, multi-billion dollar tax credits, which is basically just handing them cash to save their industries from bankruptcy defaults. And according to Axios, which did the reporting on this, the price tags could be up to $65 billion for coal and around $5 billion for nuclear.
Okay. Well, thanks, Reed.
Thank you.
Reed Frazier covers energy for the Allegheny Front and State Impact Pennsylvania. And he's also a regular host of our podcast, Trump on Earth. And you can hear all of the episodes at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Carol Holsapple. This is the Allegheny Front. Some chickens raised to produce organic eggs have a pretty good life.
This latch I always have open during the summertime when I'm letting them out. They can go out as they please.
But organic egg farmers don't have to let their poultry range free. Later on the Allegheny Front, the Trump administration wants to withdraw a new rule that would make it a requirement. Stay tuned. White nose syndrome is the disease caused by a fungus that's killing millions of bats in the U.S. and Canada. You might have seen photographs of bats clinging to the sides of caves with this fuzzy white substance on their faces. Rebecca Williams reports that scientists might have found a new way to combat white nose syndrome.
The fungus has a weakness. John Palmer is a research botanist with the U.S. Forest Service's Northern Research Station. He and his team discovered that the fungus is highly sensitive to ultraviolet light. Palmer says they used a process called comparative genomics.
We compare the genes and the DNA sequence from the pathogen to these fungi that are non-pathogenic, and we look for differences. So one of the differences that we found was that the pathogen was missing this key enzyme involved in DNA repair. And without this enzyme, the fungus is unable to repair DNA damage caused by ultraviolet light.
Palmer's team found just a couple of seconds of exposure to UV light killed the fungus. He sees this discovery as another potential tool to help treat bats with white nose syndrome. But he says they're still figuring out how that might work.
We initially thought that perhaps researchers or scientists could go into high-value target sites where perhaps some of the bats that are endangered are hibernating, and you could perhaps treat individual bats with something like a handheld light source.
He says it's also possible they could install UV lights on cave entrances to treat bats as they fly in to hibernate. The fungus has reached 33 states and 5 Canadian provinces in the past 12 years and is devastating bat colonies. Palmer says scientists need to learn more about the fungus and the disease to try to keep finding ways to outsmart it. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Only a fraction of the world's water is fresh water. A new study shows that in the U.S., it's getting saltier. The study, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, pulls data from 232 U.S. Geological Survey monitoring sites across the country that have been collected over decades. The overall trend is that fresh water is increasing in salinity and is more alkaline, especially in the East and Midwest. That means the majority of U.S. waters are saltier and have a higher pH. Study authors call it the freshwater salinization syndrome and say there are multiple reasons behind it. I talked with Ryan Utes, an assistant professor of sustainability at Chatham University and one of the study authors.
You can almost think of streams and rivers as watershed tea.
Utes says agricultural lime used on farm fields eventually dissolves into the water that drains into nearby streams and rivers. And he says we're still seeing the effects of acid rain from the 70s and 80s, which caused minerals to leach out of rocks and soil, changing the chemical composition of water to be more alkaline. And this time of year, there's another obvious contributor of salinity.
Rock salt that you put on your sidewalk isn't going to just disappear and vanish into the atmosphere. It ends up in our rivers and streams, where there could be ecological consequences.
What is the impact of this syndrome?
There's likely to be a mix of positive and negative impacts from this trend, with more dissolved chemical compounds that are related to alkalization in the water. These compounds can end up going from being in solution and dissolved to becoming a solid again. That's the process of liming in pipes. Another word for it is scaling. With greater levels of these compounds in our water, the likelihood that these chemical compounds will become solid in our municipal pipes, our industrial pipes, is elevated along with it. So we may end up with a lot more of a challenge in maintaining our infrastructure as a result. Another application where this is going to be of primary importance is those power plants and industrial entities that are using water as a cooling substance. The more stuff that is dissolved in the water from the rivers, the harder it is for that water to be released as steam. You need a higher temperature, or you need to remove those chemical compounds before you use it for a cooling purpose. Increased levels of salinity in the water also have been shown to increase rates of hypertension in humans, and that can be a problem, obviously. On the flip side, we're a little unsure at this stage how this is going to affect aquatic organisms. Aside from maybe the rocky tidal coasts, stream ecosystems are probably the most physically dynamic ecosystems on Earth because if you think about it, they endure floods and droughts and may do so even within the same year. So organisms are very adapted to dynamic conditions, including chemical conditions. Some organisms may really benefit from higher levels of alkalinity, like mussels and clams, who build shells out of calcium carbonate. With more calcium and more carbonate in the water, they're going to be more likely to be able to make their shells. Marine waters, so the ocean, is of course becoming more acidic as a result of increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. In the coastal and estuarine areas where rivers are meeting and colliding with marine waters like the Chesapeake Bay, if rivers that feed into the Chesapeake and the Delaware are becoming more alkaline, that might buffer the effects of the increasing acidity that we're seeing in marine waters.
And how is it manifesting in our region? Can you say a little bit about how what might be happening here?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's happening in Pennsylvania as well. We are seeing rivers like the Allegheny and Ohio becoming more saline and more alkaline. If you move east of Pittsburgh towards the higher elevation watersheds, and especially those with limestone in their watersheds, so another word for that is karst, that's where the streams and rivers are really increasing most rapidly. This could be because wherever there is limestone in the watershed, that was really hit hard by the acidic precipitation of the 70s and 80s and early 90s. And so the chemical compounds we're detecting now in greater concentrations probably stems from dissolved limestone.
It's kind of ironic that acid rain caused streams to become more alkaline.
It is, isn't it? It's a fascinating story, and it just goes to show how surprising science can be sometimes, because it is somewhat counterintuitive. Even in the southeast, where we don't have a lot of road salt application going on, we're still seeing rising levels of salinization and alkalization. Down in the southeast, we think it may simply be due to chemical weathering of bedrock and soils due to the acid precipitation problem that we just talked about a second ago, and also potentially due to climate change. The warmer the temperatures, the faster dissolution rates oftentimes occur. And finally, when we build cities in watersheds, we put in lots of concrete. Well, concrete slowly dissolves over time. It's going to take decades or centuries, but because rainwater is naturally acidic, it's about 5.6, that rainwater will very, very slowly dissolve the concrete, and that ends up getting expressed in our nation's waters as well.
Is your paper sort of asking people to think about how to manage some of these inputs, or what kind of recommendations could come from this type of study?
Well, as far as the on-the-ground consequences and what we would recommend people to do, I think we're at such an early stage of the research that we wouldn't be able to make solid recommendations. So one thing I could say is that we shouldn't apply so much road salts to our roads during this time of year. That's not going to turn off because people want roads that are not covered in ice, and that's totally understandable. But perhaps this research might cause us to think about how much salt we apply to our roads and sidewalks. What we hope this does is cause other watershed scientists to take a look at the problem, to elucidate what's happening, what are the major drivers of it, and what are the consequences of it, in order to make recommendations that are more concrete and specific in the future.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Cool. Thank you so much for having me in. I'm glad you gave me a chance to talk about my research, and pay attention to your rivers and streams, everybody.
Ryan Utes is an assistant professor of sustainability at Chatham University and one of the authors of Freshwater Salinization Syndrome on a Continental Scale, recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. If you buy eggs labeled organic, they can cost a lot more than regular eggs. So what are you paying for? When it comes to the treatment of livestock and poultry, there are some murky areas. Many in the organic industry have pushed for a new rule to ensure that the green and white organic seal on egg cartons means the chickens actually spent time outdoors. The Trump administration delayed that animal welfare rule 3 times before proposing to get rid of it altogether. The comment period for withdrawal of the rule ends this month. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant picks up the story.
There are so many types of eggs in the cooler at this Ohio supermarket. free range, cage free, organic.
Nope. Would not buy them. Just regular eggs is good.
Retired factory worker Judy Wells chooses a big 18-egg carton from the bottom row. But Rachel Goodrich is willing to pay more than a dollar extra for a half carton, just six, because they're organic eggs. One thing she expects from the organic label is that the animals will be treated well.
So I'm a big animal lover. I think it's worth spending an extra few dollars.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture administers the National Organic Program. For eggs to be certified, the hens must be fed organic feed and can't be given antibiotics. There's no plan to change that. But the organic industry has debated an animal welfare rule for years. So last January, as President Obama was leaving office, the USDA issued a new rule. It would require organic egg producers to allow their chickens to spend at least 6 hours a day outdoors, as they do at this hen house in rural eastern Ohio. It's set up a bit like seating in a small stadium. Along the top row are nests where the chickens lay eggs. When temperatures get above 40 degrees, the family that runs this farm opens a series of rectangular doors.
This is a door where they go out.
23-year-old Marie Erb runs this operation with her husband.
This latch I always have open during the summertime when I'm letting them out.
They can go out as they please.
The Erbs are part of a group of about 30 family farms in the region that produce eggs distributed to supermarkets in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic states. It's organized by Pete and Jerry's Organic Eggs, based in New Hampshire, which sees the new animal treatment rule as an important clarification to the organic standards. Jesse LaFlamme is Pete and Jerry's CEO. He says without the change, a few producers can tarnish the organic industry. He gives the example of Herbrook's Poultry Ranch, a major egg supplier with a huge farm in Michigan. It's added something called poultry porches to the barns.
And they've tacked a little tiny porch on the side of them where a fraction of the hens in those barns might be able to go out at one time if they could actually find their way to it.
Poultry porches are currently allowed under organic standards, but that would change with the new rule. Herbrooks declined an interview for this story, but it pointed to comments on the rule by the National Assembly of State Animal Health Officials that says poultry porches help protect birds so they aren't vulnerable to predators and disease. Caitlin McCulloch is with the American Farm Bureau Federation, a group that lobbies on behalf of farmers and ranchers. Her organization wants the rule withdrawn because it could prevent some of her members from using the valuable organic label.
Many farmers and ranchers had already invested in the organic system and made some substantial changes to how they did things just to transition to organic, and that this would be an additional hoop to jump through. And that might not all be possible for all organic producers.
But the Organic Trade Association supports the rule and says it balances the expectations of organic consumers with the realities of commercial livestock and poultry production. The group points out that the rule took 10 years to create. It's suing the USDA for failing to put the rule into action. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant in Sugar Creek, Ohio.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at trumponearth.org. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.